Thank you, Howard, for your very generous introduction. I have to admit I'm a little uncomfortable with the Michigan group because I was really raised on Minnesota rivalry with Michigan. Now, I recognize that that rivalry for the little brown jug predated Michigan State's entry into the Big Ten, and that your rivalry with Michigan is parallel to my own. These remarks were made designed before last Saturday's debacle of 42-0, but I think in the olden days, why Minnesota amateur football was collegiate football was a fit rival for Michigan, and I think now you recognize that in professionally we also are a pretty good match for you Detroiters. Actually, the rivalry between Minnesota and Michigan for the little brown jug was matched by the rivalry between our store and its rival store for being able to display that little brown jug in our corner windows. And those corner windows are right kitty corner across the main street in Minneapolis. And one year my father walked by Donaldson's, the rival store, and saw in the corner window a little pile of sawdust and a little sign on it saying that this spot reserved for the little brown jug. And so with great glee, he walked across to his office and called up the rival president of that store and said, "You may have a spot reserved for the little brown jug, but you just may be interested in knowing that that little brown jug is in our window." Now, instead of rivalry, however, there's a true partnership. The J.L. Hudson Company, with its large stake in and around the Detroit area, represents a significant portion of our company. Since joining forces 3 years ago, we have developed a strong partnership that has strengthened us both and enabled each to serve our communities more effectively. We've come to regard Michigan State as a member of this partnership, too. In fact, this institution has been a prime contributor of management talent to Hudson's. There are 62 MSU graduates on Hudson's management team today, 34 of them products of the university's course in retailing. And regularly, many more have attended your night classes and received a degree in retailing that has spurred them on in their merchandising career. Because the emphasis of this conference is on tomorrow's manager, I thought it appropriate to consider with you what tomorrow's corporation might be like. It is certain that both tomorrow's managers and tomorrow's corporation will be different from yesterday's and today's. Great schools such as Michigan State are helping to reshape the manager. The question is, how will we as managers reshape the corporation? Or can we together at least think through the ways the corporation needs to reshape itself so that it can best fulfill its role of service to society? Business functions by public consent. Its basic purpose is to serve constructively the needs of society, and it must do so to the satisfaction of society, or society will not grant it the opportunity to grow profitably. Exponential change has been the dominant characteristic of our century, and it will surely continue its pervasive influence throughout the 70s. The pace of change has accelerated, and it undoubtedly will continue to accelerate. Its impact on the business environment will intensify economically and socially. Business is highly adaptive and has demonstrated its ability to respond to the accelerating changes of the marketplace. However, it has been less eager to respond to social changes in society. Too often it has resisted and fought a rearguard action. Too often it has displayed a reluctance to change until that change has been forced upon it. I am sure that we'll be able to respond to the economic changes of the 70s, but my query is whether business is adapting itself to the rapidly changing social factors in its environment. Social factors which can't help but change some of the ground rules under which we will operate in the future. And a key point is whether those rules of the game will be changed for us or whether business will foresightedly participate in developing the rule changes. But first, let's look at the dramatic changes to which business has responded in the past decade, for that is certainly an indicator of the degree of change required in the next decade. The company I represent is, I think, a good example of companies that had to respond to the dramatic changes in the marketplace in the 60s. 10 years ago, Hudson's and Dayton's were two local independent department stores. We recognize that local department stores could not grow rapidly enough to hold their relative competitive position against the inroads of the major national retailing companies, Sears, Penney's, Federated, and others. In this retail revolution of the 60s, it was clear that the big were getting bigger and that we would have to become a major factor in the marketplace in order to survive over the long pull. As a result, Hudson's and Dayton's joined together. In addition, we found other independents, department stores in Portland, Oregon, and in Phoenix, a hard goods discounter in Boston, who viewed the situation much as we did. With the strength of our department stores, we have been able to grow internally into other areas of retailing as well, low-margin discounting, specialty stores, and shopping centers. Today, just 10 years later, Dayton Hudson finds itself the nation's 12th largest non-food retailer, operating in more than 100 communities in 26 states from Boston to San Diego and from Detroit to Houston, and doing business at a rate of about $1.25 billion a year. Our story, of course, is not unique. Many other companies have experienced comparably explosive growth. Here in Detroit, you have a phenomenal example of economic adaptability in the history of the Kresge Company. We, as well as so many others, have the greatest admiration for their achievement. Its management saw that the variety of store had limited growth opportunity and that would have to reshape the company, adapt it to the emerging forces of the marketplace in order to grow at an acceptable rate of return in the future. That it did, and then some, making Kmart a symbol of low-margin merchandising throughout the nation. Such changes haven't been confined to retailing companies, obviously. Whole industries have had to change and adapt to new forces. The conservative banking industry saw that its source of demand deposits would provide it with limited growth opportunity. So it rethought its role and now conceives of itself as a provider of a whole range of financial and other services, effectively amending its traditional role as primarily just a lender of funds left in the bank by its depositors. These are just a few indications of businesses' ability to adapt to the rapidly changing economic forces in the marketplace. Many more could be cited. They serve to assure us that vast change has taken place in a rather brief period of time, and that equal or greater change and adaptability will be required in the future, for the process is continual. We, like all business, are considering what the factors are that will affect change in the future. Of course, there are many such factors, but the most startling one that we see in the immediate years ahead is the growth of the 25 to 34-year-old age group. The population of the country as a whole will grow about 12% during the 70s, but this age group will grow 4 times that rate, increasing by almost 50%. This tremendous bulge in the population chart started out as the baby boom following World War II. Now it is rapidly becoming the dominant influence on our consumer markets and is dramatically changing the way retailers and others think and operate. The resulting surge of new household formations, of new families with large discretionary incomes, cannot help but have a profound effect on the marketplace. However, it is obvious that they are open to new forms of merchandising. For it has been said that teenagers who were brought up on McDonald's hamburgers are going to be willing to do their shopping for general merchandise in different settings than their predecessors ever were willing to consider. The forms of retailing are undergoing marked change as a result. It has been suggested that by 1976, one half of the food sold will be handled by stores that do not exist today. Warehouse configurations are developing that would have been scorned by the traditional retailer and his traditional customer a few years ago. The 25 to 34-year-old age group is not only growing rapidly and will have more spendable income, but those who are entering it have a different lifestyle, a different set of values. Their economic influence is only an indicator of the degree of change that they will bring about in all aspects of society. And certainly they have a different attitude towards business. Just as we can analyze and predict their spending patterns, so I think we can analyze and predict some of their attitudes. We can get a compelling statistical preview of these attitudes from studies of the shifting climate of campus opinion. notably those studies conducted by Daniel Yankelovich for the John D. Rockefeller III and his Task Force on Youth. A basic finding, with which we are all generally familiar, was that doubt about the motives of business are widespread and growing among students. In a 1969 survey, 50% of all students interviewed strongly agreed that business was overly concerned with profits and not with public responsibility. In 1970, the figure had risen to 61%, and only 5% disagreed. In 1970, 45% of all students interviewed advocated fundamental reform of big business, compared with 35% in 1969. In fact, business came off just a nod ahead of the military and the penal system in the students' view. It didn't do nearly as well as the trade unions, universities, the mass media, Congress, or the courts. The findings showed that the most vocal of the college students expressed increasing concern with racism, the unequal economic distribution of our wealth, and the soundness of the economic structure of society. The research report said that while the majority of the students are still hopeful that the American system of representative democracy can respond effectively to the needs of the people, there are also indications of growing doubts. Only 10% thought that the American way of life is superior to that of other countries. And yet the survey showed that 68% believe the system is flexible enough to solve the problems and overcome flaws without radical change. It has become increasingly clear, the report concludes, that the student rebellion is not a transient phenomenon, a product solely of the Vietnam War or the generation gap or the failings of our universities. Rather, it is a movement of increasing significance, signaling vast changes in American culture. The student rebellion reflects a revolution in values that is destined to spread its influence from the campus throughout the full breadth of society. Obviously, this rebellion is already spreading its influence. It certainly nominated George McGovern, and while it probably can't elect him, it may well represent a trend that is irreversible. The young people whom Senator McGovern initially inspired will be assuming positions of increased responsibility at early ages in their career. Their expectations of business are deeply rooted in the social, political, and cultural forces that will bear heavily on the future of corporate America. The Committee for Economic Development recognized this trend in a recent report on social responsibility, in which it states, "These broadened expectations of business have been building up for some time. This is indicated by the trends in public opinion over a number of years, and by the resultant actions of government in responding to the public will through an increasing variety of measures to protect consumer interests, to clean up the environment, and to enhance equal opportunities for employment and career development in industry. The evidence strongly suggests that these are solid and durable trends, not momentary frustrations or fads, and that they are likely to increase rather than to diminish in the future. Today it is clear, the CED asserts, that the terms of the contract between society and business are, in fact, changing in substantial and important ways. Business is being asked to assume broader responsibilities to society than ever before and to serve a wider range of human values. Business enterprises, in effect, are being asked to contribute more to the quality of American life than just supplying quantities of goods and services. Inasmuch as business exists to serve society, its future will depend on the quality of management's response to the changing expectations of the public. I submit that our young citizens are not alone in feeling that something is out of joint when our growing affluence is swallowed up in a deteriorating environment, when the quantity of income rises but the quality of life declines. They aren't alone in worrying that computers and other technology are creating a cold, impersonal world. They aren't the only citizens who are concerned whether the problems of our urban existence and the scale of our technological approach have combined to thwart the pursuit of happiness. That they have begun to resist is not really surprising, because men and women will ultimately fight back at any time they feel their basic humanity is under attack. Other major institutions have observed these trends and have attempted to reshape themselves accordingly. The Catholic Church is a pillar of conservatism, yet it has tackled major reform aggressively. The Democratic Party faced up to some drastic changes in its last convention, which was in marked contrast to 1968, and set the stage for a new pattern in 1976. Our school system has been forced to reorient its thinking. Of all these institutions, business, the church, politics, education, business is considered to be the most adaptive, and I'm sure that its record warrants that reputation. Yet the others are giving more thought to basic change than business is. Even though business has a tremendous investment in the future, even though the directions of the winds of change indicate that we need to consider reshaping business to protect and enhance that investment. If the most rapidly growing segment of the population we serve, and the one with the most economic clout, has a new set of values, business had better start adapting. I've already cited evidence that business is willing and able to adjust to new ideas from consumers as to the goods and services they want and the way they want to buy them. I believe that it follows that business will also have to adjust their attitude toward life, towards bigness and technology, to their sense of humanity. The basic form of business has remained unchanged for quite some time. I don't expect revolutionary changes are in order now, but I do think there's ample room for adjustment. I'm a firm believer in the profit system, but perhaps profit needs to be considered as a means to an end and not an end in itself. Unfortunately, I don't have the answers, but I do think that we can start listing some of the questions to which business should give consideration. A primary of consideration today is the extent of business's social responsibility. Professor Milton Friedman states it this way. There is one and only one social responsibility of business, he states, to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits so long as it stays within the rules of the game, which is to say, engages in open and free competition without deception and fraud. Few trends could so thoroughly undermine the very foundation of our free society as the acceptance by corporate officials of a social responsibility other than to make as much money for their stockholders as possible. Others disagree with Professor Friedman, arguing persuasively that business must concern itself not only with its basic function, but also with a whole array of social responsibilities. Some propose, in fact, that business make an annual accounting of how well they meet these social responsibilities. The idea of a social audit has been around for some time, yet it remains a very vague concept. Business is in relative agreement of what a financial audit comprises, but there can be little agreement at this point on whether a similar approach can be applied meaningfully to the imponderables of corporate responsibility. Perhaps, though, the time is already here for listing some of the key elements to which business should respond. Several corporations, including General Motors and our own, have appointed committees of the board on corporate social responsibility. A start has been made, but the extent of the task has yet to be defined. One of the most intriguing approaches to corporate social responsibility is the concept that business should organize companies to perform social functions. One person who has spoken out clearly in this area is a fellow Minneapolitan, James Summer, president of General Mills. Now, General Mills is a very profitable and successful company, yet its president has proposed that businesses establish public service subsidiaries with a lower standard of profitability than the balance of the corporation. He suggests that the need at this point is not the computer readout of the perfect solution, but simply clear-cut evidence that we are moving out in the generally correct direction. And he further suggests that there is an opportunity for large corporations to do just that. Mr. Summers' specific proposal is, and I quote, that 8 to 10 large companies in the Twin Cities assume the responsibility for operating in 3 or 4 of these growing gray service areas. Each company would form a subsidiary with staff and financial support as a bona fide slice of its corporate whole, fully committed at a risk of reputation as any other commercial activity it engages in. It would compete with 1 or 2 other companies in the selected area. It would operate at a profit, but a return on equity of perhaps 5%, and it would debt leverage from, say, 80 to 90%. Lending institutions would play their own role by providing capital at rates marginally above cost and against the security of the subsidiary and not of the parent. And interestingly enough, our local Citizens League, approaching the problem from an entirely different viewpoint, that of governmental efficiency, has suggested that government become a purchaser of services rather than always providing the service itself. Such a concept would enable public boards to free up their time dramatically so that time devoted to the problems of their employees could be spent instead thinking out the needs of their constituencies. They list other benefits and conclude by urging other organizations, business organizations in particular, to take the initiative by developing their capability for delivery of services and by coming forward with proposals of their own. Another new area of business concern, or lack of concern in some cases, is consumerism. This is a prime area where business needs to reshape its attitudes. Too many businessmen regard consumerism as a threat rather than an opportunity. We have failed to perceive ahead of time the legitimate demands of the consumer and respond positively to them. We need to ally ourselves with the consumer, to be on his side of the table rather than across the table. Tomorrow's manager will have a great deal to contribute in this area, but so should those of us in management today. How important it is that the consumer view business as his or her ally in achieving a better life. We know that we are not so perceived today, but if we could make that switch, a major portion of our problem would be licked. Boards of directors are undergoing change. Their role is being challenged and their composition altered. This is tacit admission on the part of management that the role of business has changed, that people expect something different from it than previously. And don't we need to think out who does have a right to sit on the board of directors? Is it just the stockholder who is now solidly in control and who can hence give token representation to the public? Or is a sharing of responsibility in order? Is the business corporation a partnership consisting of the shareholder, the employee, and the public? If it is, then should the latter two have significant representation on the board? At Dayton Hudson, we recently added Paul Ilvesacker to our board. Paul is dean of the Graduate School of Education at Harvard and generally recognized as one of the nation's leading sociologists. At a recent meeting, he commented facetiously that Dayton Hudson was looking for a black Catholic woman and came up with me. But we have found that his addition has real commercial value, for his insights into what is going on in society are extremely valuable. This has proven to us that adding a different point of view is not a risk, but a real asset to the corporation. The ownership of corporations is another area we need to consider. I've just returned from a trip studying European retailing. While I certainly don't understand French accounting, I judge that in some cases up to one half of the pre-tax profits of a corporation go into a profit-sharing trust for employees. Sears is America's most successful retailer, and certainly a large part of that success is due to the fact that its employees own 21% of the stock of that great company through a profit-sharing fund. Retired employees, of course, own a large share in addition. Various schemes are currently being advanced for making capitalists of our employees, although not enough work has yet been done to indicate any clear patterns of success. But could there be a better way to change the attitude of public toward business than by making more people part owners of the business system? The whole area of employee-employer relationships is changing. The emerging force of women's awareness means that tomorrow's managers will have a much more equitable balance between male and female than a glance around this room would indicate is the case today. More and more women are seeking and finding self-expressive goals outside their traditional homebound roles. Even now, 35% of wives are working compared with 25% 10 years ago. The kind of work experience that befits an individual is a subject that is receiving major consideration from industry. Those of you in the automobile industry are keenly aware of this, but all of us have some sort of job enrichment program in mind. The trend toward greater individuality is carrying over to the job. Employees at all levels are seeking greater satisfaction in their work. Some European companies are responding by giving employees 2 or 3 hours leeway in the starting or ending of their working day. The 4-day week is now an interesting experiment in this country, but it's part of the recognition that corporations have an obligation to create a job experience that enhances rather than degrades the individual. The relationship between the company and the employee is changing, and the contract, whether written or unwritten, with the new generation is bound to reflect the new value judgments as well as the realities of the marketplace. The obligation of corporations to make charitable gifts is another subject of consideration. The law permits deductions up to 5% of pre-tax income, but the average of all corporations approximates 1%, or 1/5 of the total allowable amount. What a tremendous change in society could be effected if corporations looked upon this as an area of opportunity rather than just a business expense. We at Dayton Hudson for a long time have utilized 5% of our pre-tax income for the benefit of the environments of which we are a part. As retailers, we feel that the success of our business is intimately related to the well-being of the communities of which we are a part. Therefore, we think it in the shareholders' best interest to utilize the talents of an environmental development department and 5% of our pre-tax income to work toward the healthy growth of these areas. If all business took such a point of view, it could have a tremendous impact on some of the social problems which now threaten the health of our communities and hence so much of business's investment. The location of our business has always been considered a corporate prerogative. Computerized systems have been developed utilizing primarily such factors as wage rates, tax rates, and freight rates. Government has largely followed a hands-off policy and allowed business to develop in whatever way seemed most economically logical. As a result, our population centers have urban sprawl of the most unattractive sort, while smaller, attractive communities are declining for lack of employment opportunity. In the Twin Cities, we have a Metropolitan Council that is undertaking some form of urban planning, but it is a far cry from the rigid governmental control that exists in France, for instance. I understand that government has determined that there will be 17 major shopping centers circling Paris, no more, no less. Rather than the indiscriminate growth of free enterprise, a planned environment will be developed. By and large, American business has failed to develop the advantages of good planning, to the point where we seem to be asking society to impose it upon us. Certainly, human factors will play a greater role in the future, perhaps an even more important role than economic factors. One way or another, business inevitably will have to fit into the concept of a planned community where human values take precedence. Social responsibility, consumerism, composition of boards of directors, ownership of the corporation, charitable giving, these are just a few of the areas of concern which business should consider as it reshapes itself for the 70s. Obviously, if we could sit down and have a discussion, we could list many more and effectively establish our priorities. As I've said, the history of business has been that of effective adaptation to the changing forces of the marketplace, but a reluctance to submit to social change. Now, however, the changing social forces, spearheaded by the younger age group, are becoming so powerful that business will have to respond if it is to enjoy an environment conducive to its profitable growth in the 70s. I would like to conclude with a quote from John Coakley, editor of the magazine published by the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. In his article, he makes no reference to business as one of the institutions that needs to reshape themselves. But in our own mind, we can readily insert business as we consider whether his comments are just as applicable to us as they are to education, the church, and the other institutions to which he refers. He states, "The basic institutions of society were not geared to deal with the new consciousness when it appeared. Methods of organization that had worked in the past were abruptly outmoded. Traditional modes of operation were seen as threatening after it became evident that established institutions were no longer reflecting the real interests of the men and women they were designed to serve. The students, the soldiers, the clergyman's view of image of himself no longer jibed with the official identity conferred upon him by the university, the army, or the church. The old rules and regulations, it became clear soon enough, were written for a breed on its way out. This discrepancy was at the root of the unrest and revolt that characterized the time. In the disorder that followed, perhaps predictably, there was a widespread, somewhat mindless attack on the very idea of institutions, and a good deal of talk about abolishing them altogether. We were to have politics without parties, education without schools, law without courts, justice without jails, and religion without churches. But it does not take a profound student of human nature to realize that societies cannot live without institutions. There is simply no other way for men and women to act together. It is equally obvious, however, that these institutions have to reflect the self-image of the men and women they are supposed to serve, and that when they no longer do, there is no choice but to reshape them and reform them. For that reason, above all others, the major task ahead is an intellectual one. It will take a great deal of thought and dialogue and creativity to remake the church, the political party, the press, the school, and even the family into institutions fit to serve men and women who are intent, come hell or high water, on achieving ever more personal freedom and autonomy for themselves and their children. And I suggest that a great school such as Michigan State is one place where thought and dialogue should take place to help reshape business into an institution more fit to serve men and women. Thank you.